This time of year, if things have gone well in your garden, you are up to your elbows in homegrown tomatoes. If things haven't gone well, you're dependent on farmers markets and the kindness of neighbors. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There is nothing that can compare to the taste of a tomato fresh from your garden. And that is a matter of great controversy and conflict among tomato lovers, foodies, and tomato producers. Today, we'll explore the history of the tomato, its wild origins, the path it took to European tables, and what it took to get people in the United States hooked. We'll also talk about tomato genetics, homogenization and mass production, and the resurgence of heirloom varieties. My guest today is Arthur Allen, the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the time of year that tomato lovers live for, when every day you can go out into the garden and pick fresh, ripe tomatoes. You have to dream up different ways to eat them so none of them go to waste. And then there's the rest of the year, which is pretty bleak for tomato lovers. You might find a nice, ripe, red-looking tomato at the grocery store, but when you cut into it, it's tough, pale, and tasteless. Today, we're going to talk about tomatoes, from the sublime to the inedible. My guest is Arthur Allen. He is the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Hello, Arthur.
Hello there. How are you?
Oh, very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
I want to talk first about the origins of the tomato. Where did the tomato come from?
Well, wild tomatoes developed in Western South America, in Peru, Ecuador, Chile, that area now. And there are still about 18 quite distinct species. But it doesn't seem that the Peruvians cultivated the tomatoes, although they must certainly have eaten them. There's no sort of native South American words for the tomato. However, when the tomato got to Mexico and Central America, it was very warmly received. And in fact, just about every Indian tribe in Mexico has a name, its own name for the tomatoes, which indicates how sort of firmly the tomato had been accepted in Mexico by the time of the conquest. And then after the conquest, of course, through Spain and probably through the Philippines, tomato spread all around the world.
So tell me a little bit about that cultivation in Mexico. What do we know about the ways that, for example, the Aztecs would have used the tomato?
Well, one of my favorite recipes involves sort of the tender inner thigh of a slave. But, you know, that was pretty unusual. That was only for the nobles. I think when you look at the recipe or the descriptions from some of these Spanish priests who hung out with Nahuatl scribes, sort of collecting information about the ways of the Aztec, you find uses that are very similar to what we think of as Mexican cuisine today. Moles involving many different spices, tomatoes, all kinds of sauces that are, you know, involve chilies often. Really what you think of along the basic lines of Mexican cuisine today, with a lot of diversity and a lot of different, they didn't have a lot of meat other than human sacrifice, which didn't happen very often. And so they ate things on larva and rabbit occasionally. I guess they had wild turkey, but a lot of tomato sauces that went on these things and all kinds of tomatoes. I mean, it's very tantalizing to look at the list of different tomatoes that Bernardino de Sahagún's scribes recorded, because there are things like called coyote tomatoes and sand tomatoes, and all kinds of different shapes and colors and flavors are described there, and we don't really know exactly what those all signify.
Well, you mentioned the wild tomatoes that, of course, the tomatoes that we know originally came from. If I were to come across a wild tomato plant, would I recognize the fruit?
Yeah. Well, I've looked at about, there's a wonderful greenhouse in UC Davis where they grow out a number of these wild species. And I was fortunate enough to look at them, and you know, they all look vaguely like tomatoes, but they're quite different. One of them, the most distinct one, was something that grew in the Ecuadorian jungle, and it really looked like the leaves looked like the leaves of a walnut tree, and it was said to have a vine that would grow, you know, 50 feet up into the air onto trees, and the fruit don't look anything like what we think of as a tomato. They're actually hard and green. And then there are others that are sort of shading toward what we think of as a tomato. And one species, Lycopersicum pimpinella folium, is also known as the currant tomato. And a lot of heirloom farmers grow those. Their little tiny fruit can be very sweet. And so those are, you know, quite similar to the tomato, to what we know of as the tomato.
When the conquistadors took tomatoes back to Spain and they began to be introduced around Europe, how were they received?
Well, they were initially received with great skepticism. In Northern Europe, which is where most of the sort of botanical books and medical texts from that early, you know, late, you know, sort of 16th, 17th century come from, they were all almost exclusively viewed as something that was dangerous and unhealthful, but although often they said these are only something that someone in Southern Europe could eat, because they had a lot of different ideas about what it was correct to eat, you know, sort of regionally and racially and this kind of thing. And it took quite a while for it to catch on. I mean, even in Italy, sort of among the noble classes, it didn't catch on until sort of mid-19th century. Although the first pizza restaurants in Naples were probably in the early 18th century.
So it's so funny to think of that, because, of course, when we think about Italian food, the tomato plays such an important role. It's funny to think about Italy without tomatoes.
Yes. I mean, and it really is. And the funny thing about the tomato sort of as a global cuisine is it really didn't take off in a major way until the Italian diaspora of the late 19th century, early 20th century, when something like a quarter of all Italians were living overseas because of, you know, the economic disaster there, sort of similar to the Irish diaspora. And these Italians who settled in places like New York, Chicago, you know, well, all over the U.S. and Australia and Argentina and other places, were often from the South, and the tomato had been a Southern peasant, you know, fare for some time. And so these people, they created a canning industry in Italy that was created to feed the desires of these immigrants. And then it caught on in all the places where the immigrants lived. And then, so that kind of cuisine, which so many of us think of as Italian cuisine, was really created to serve these immigrants. And then it kind of conquered Italy in a way. Not that, of course, Italy has to this day, you know, many different kinds of cuisines, not all of which obviously are tomato-based.
So did the tomato that conquered the United States, did that come from Europe or did that come from Mexico where it was first cultivated?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think it may have come from both, because there was a lot of trade between Central America and the southern United States, especially through New Orleans. And so it's very likely you see some very early records, you know, 18th century records of tomatoes being eaten in New Orleans, where I suspect, you know, which was mostly, you know, a Spanish and French city. And I suspect people had more liberal attitudes about cuisine. And so it could have come from there. I mean, Thomas Jefferson had tomatoes in his garden, but he didn't really eat them.
Right, he just liked to look at them?
Yeah. They were ornamentals, basically. That was the prevailing view at that time in Britain. So I'm not really sure how they come over, but because they probably were coming over as ornamentals quite a bit in the late 18th century. But it isn't until the mid-19th century that they get any traction at all as food in the United States.
And there is this apocryphal story that many of us have heard about a man standing on the steps of the Salem, New Jersey courthouse eating, some people say he ate a bushel of tomatoes to convince people that tomatoes were not poisonous and that they were good food. Did that happen?
Well, apparently not. I mean, I didn't research that myself, but other writers have looked into that, and there doesn't seem to be anything to it. And it seems to correlate pretty closely with a tomato festival that was created in Salem, which, you know, claiming that feat for its town would certainly help, I guess, attract visitors to the annual tomato festival and bring some cash in. So I think that's the basis for it.
Was there skepticism about the tomato, though, being poisonous since it is related to poisonous plants?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is this, you know, connection to belladonna and deadly nightshade, you know, from a botanical perspective. But I always have been suspicious that that's the real reason people didn't eat them. Because, I mean, how much did the average sort of person know about, you know, Linnaean biology? And I think it was more that they were just, you know, tomatoes are a really different kind of food. They're not exactly sweet, they're not exactly savory, and so people were suspicious of them, and there was a lot more to be suspicious of. I mean, there was a lot less understood about nature and about, you know, so people sort of stuck to what they knew, and that's sort of what I suspect was the basis for it, that it was just something odd and sort of better not to mess with it.
And people didn't necessarily know how to eat it.
Right, right. Well, that's right. The idea of putting it on pasta, you know, didn't, certainly that came over from Italy much later.
How did it become popular in the U.S.?
Well, again, it was this through the emigration of large numbers of Italians and them setting up restaurants in the cities where they'd settled. And, you know, people finding this was quite a tasty thing. But it had actually become somewhat more in use through Union troops during the Civil War ate a lot of tomatoes because the canning industry was just getting started. And there's evidence that Union soldiers ate a lot of tomatoes. They left a lot of tomato cans in their wake, in their camps, and so on. So it was starting to get big then, and after the war, we have the records of some of the first tomato breeders, such as Mr. Livingston, who lived in outside Columbus, Ohio.
And we'll talk more about him in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, and we're talking about tomatoes with Arthur Allen today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today I'm talking with Arthur Allen. He's the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. And we've been talking about the history of the tomato as it made its way from South America and Central America to Europe and to the United States, and its rise in popularity through the Italian diaspora. And we'd love to have you join the conversation. If you have some tomato questions or tomato stories you'd like to share, the number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we are going to be talking about modern tomatoes shortly. We'll talk about the resurgence of heirloom varieties and those tomatoes you can buy at the grocery store, you get at fast food restaurants that so many of us love to hate. The number again is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Arthur, when the Union troops were eating those tin tomatoes during the Civil War, what kind of tomato were they eating?
Well, they were, you know, kind of the traditional sort of knobby, I mean, they would look like an heirloom tomato, like a big red, sort of like a beefsteak. farmers like them and still do like large tomatoes because you get more money for large tomatoes because you pay lower wage costs because, you know, each time the farmer, the picker reaches out and grabs a tomato, he's holding something that weighs half a pound rather than, you know, a cherry or something that weighs a lot less than that. My understanding is that, you know, those were the preferred kinds. But what exactly varieties, I'm not really sure.
But you write about the fact that through the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, there wasn't a lot of genetic diversity to the tomatoes that we had in the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a basic problem, which is that when the tomato goes from Mexico to Spain, there's a genetic bottleneck. And people have done a lot of interesting research, some tomato geneticists, that looks at sort of the varieties, the genetic varieties of tomatoes in Peru, and then in Mexico, and then in the rest of the world. And really, all of these unusual shapes, colors, and so on that we're seeing in heirlooms represent a very small number of genetic mutations and or genetic changes of any kind. And so although it seems that there's this huge amount of diversity, strictly in genetic terms, most of the diversity is in these old tomatoes that we don't even consider tomatoes that, you know, grow wild in the New World.
What kind of problems did that create, having a fairly small genetic pool for all of these different tomatoes?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
What kind of problems did that create for people who were trying to grow them?
Well, yeah, I mean, so you had these problems with vulnerabilities of tomatoes to all kinds of, fungi, viruses, bacterial growths, insects. And when you look at the New World tomatoes, you know, they've sort of adapted to most of these things. And before any of that genetic germplasm from South America was brought back into the tomato through breeding programs, there was this huge susceptibility. And I think the first tomato that was developed for commercial farming in the U.S. that had resistance to wilt, which is a major problem with tomatoes, it's, you know, still is in your backyard. That wasn't until, I think, the 20s or 30s. That was only to one wilt, and it was probably another 20 years before they had found resistances to other organisms. So, yeah, I mean, this bottleneck had created a huge vulnerability of these tomatoes to organisms.
I want you to tell us a little bit about Charlie Rick, who founded the Tomato Genetics Resource Center at the University of California, Davis, which you mentioned earlier, which is a source for so much tomato research in the United States. Tell me a little bit about Dr. Rick.
Well, right. I mean, Rick, it's a perfect opportunity to talk about him because what he did is, among other things, he took more than a dozen trips to South America gathering huge amounts of tomatoes, both Lycopersicum esculentum, the species that we eat, and other varieties. And his objective was to bring back all of these varieties and to find useful genes. And he was interested in helping the tomato business. That was what his job was as an agricultural person at Davis. And so what he did is he brought back all of these species, all these different collections, and he would grow them in his greenhouse, and he would cross them with traditional traditional species in the U.S. in his lab. And he would find resistances and other traits that were of interest to commercial growers, especially in the California tomato business. That program that he started is, you know, there wouldn't be a tomato business without it. I mean, it was completely crucial to the whole system.
When did he start doing this research?
Well, he started in the late 40s, and he continued up to almost up to his death in, I think, 2001. Over 5 decades, he made these trips to South America. And, you know, there's some wonderful stories. He trained a lot of really, really brilliant scientists, some of whom stayed in the tomato line, and others went into other things and, developed important races, and, you know, people who were very big figures in the Green Revolution, for example, came out of his lab. So, and he was a big, bearded guy who went around riding his bicycle with no shirt on through David. He was a real fixture of the landscape and a real, kind of character, and much beloved person.
Well, when we think about genetic manipulation of plants now, I think most of us think about white lab coats and petri dishes and all of that.
Right.
But the way you describe him, he's almost like the Indiana Jones of tomatoes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was out there, on these wild trips and would, drive his little, would get a hold of a little VW bug and drive all over Peru and collecting things, and sometimes the bug would break down and he would be waiting for a part, and he'd be sitting by the side of the road typing his notes for 3 days while somebody was out trying to get this part for him. And he was just one of these people who didn't care about appearances or anything like that. It was very devoted to science, but also a very fun person who you could talk to about almost anything. So I suppose, from the perspective of food and of our aesthetics of tomatoes, what he brought is somewhat of a mixed blessing. I mean, it's really a blessing because it wasn't until, once people started to worry about flavor in food again, there were plenty of opportunities to find tomatoes that had good flavor. But for decades and decades, the farmers kind of drove the whole operation, and what they wanted was big tomatoes that were resistant to, wilts and viruses and so on, that they could, count on every year producing, and they didn't care very much about what they tasted like. And so that was very much to our disadvantage, all of us, and if you wanted to have a good tomato, for many decades, you had to grow it yourself, and it had to be something that you was handed down. But you do have to think, okay, all those years when we were forced to eat these kind of mediocre tomatoes. I mean, even a mediocre tomato provides you with good nutrition,
mm-hmm.
And so we do have Charlie Rick and others to thank for that, even if it was sort of a mixed blessing.
Right. Well, both a blessing and a curse in some ways. And
right.
we'll talk more about that after our break. Arthur Allen is the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato, and you can join our conversation today, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Definition: tomato, noun, the usually large, rounded, typically red or yellow, pulpy berry of an herb. A plant that is a tender perennial, widely cultivated for its edible fruit. So where do I fit in exactly? Now I'm all alone, and the dictionaries have spoken. You know what I'm gonna do? I'll start a new movement, a new direction. I've been writing down some recipes.
From NPR News.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today is Arthur Allen. He's the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. And we'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk about modern tomatoes now, the modern tomato industry, the tomatoes you can get at the grocery store, and the tomatoes that you can grow in your garden today. So let us know what you like to grow in your garden. How do you make that decision when you're faced with all those plants and seeds in the spring? Do you grow heirlooms? Do you grow modern hybrids? Do you grow a mixture? Let us know what your favorites are. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Arthur, before the break, we were talking about Charlie Rick and his research at the Tomato Genetics Research Center at UC Davis. And he, along with many other characters, helped develop the modern tomato that we can ship all over the world, that won't get squashed when it goes in the box, that we can pick green and ripen later. And although a lot of us dislike that tomato a lot, it really has changed the landscape of tomato agriculture. I know another one of the people involved in that process heavily was named Jack Hanna. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that they did together?
Yeah, I mean, so Charlie Rick brought the genes. Jack Hanna was a breeder, and there was a guy named Kobe Lorenzen, also at UC Davis, who was an engineer. And after Hanna sort of searched all over the world, all over the U.S. mainly, for a tomato that would be, that was hard enough, he wanted a tomato that was you could harvest mechanically. And Lorenzo was trying to develop a machine that for mechanical harvesting, and they worked very closely together. It was kind of an interesting hybrid operation, as it were. And this was right when the Bracero program was ending. This was the program that brought a lot of Mexican laborers over to the U.S. legally during World War II and afterwards. And so the farmers in the Central Valley of California at first didn't perceive a need for this, but gradually did as they started to labor shortages. And basically, they developed the modern harvest processing tomato, which is still very much used. If you go to California or anywhere in the world where these tomatoes are grown, they're about the shape and size of an egg. They all ripen at exactly the same time on a tomato bush, and they have what's known as field storage, meaning that after they get ripe, you can leave them on the vine for a week or two and they won't rot, or they'll rot more slowly than they used to. And so this, was a huge advantage for creating, these incredibly, rich harvests of this tomato, where I've been out in the field and watched these harvesters work, and they'll harvest about a ton of tomatoes in about 10 seconds. I mean, they're just, these tomato plants are yield incredibly well. The tomatoes themselves don't taste like anything, and most of them are made into commercial concentrated paste, which is then reconstituted and made into spaghetti sauces and all these other things. But the idea of designing the tomato that when the machine hit the plant, the tomato would stay on the vine, and then it would be carried up on a conveyor belt on to the top of the machine and then shaken, and the tomatoes were supposed to fall off, and the stem was with the stem not attached, so just the tomato fell off. It took a lot of engineering because traditionally, tomatoes, they had a vine that would sort of stick to the tomato when you picked it, and there would be a tear in the tomato. But these, it came off very smoothly.
Right, you're talking about genetic engineering of the tomato, not just engineering of the machine.
Right. I mean, and it was all through traditional breeding. I mean, it wasn't done in laboratories. It was done out in the field. But, yeah, I mean, these tomatoes were genetically modified through traditional breeding so that they had all these characteristics. One of the very famous genes was the jointless gene, which Charlie Rick, through incredible sort of labor, had derived from a wild tomato that grew on the islands, one of the Galapagos Islands, and had brought it back to the States. And he'd noticed this in the wild plants. When he brought it back, he couldn't get the seeds to germinate. He had to get a friend at UCSF, San Francisco, who had a giant Galapagos turtle to sort of eat the tomatoes. And he discovered that when they passed through the giant turtle's digestive system, you could then germinate them. That was the only way to germinate them. But then once he germinated them, he crossed them with traditional tomatoes and introduced this gene they contained, the jointless gene. And that became, very key to the whole development of so-called processing tomatoes, which are tomatoes that are, canning tomatoes or are going to be turned into paste. So that people love that story because, he'd be in his laboratory late at night going through huge amounts of turtle shit that his friend would mail to him from San Francisco, and he would, be looking for these seeds and trying to get them to germinate. The whole lab stank, and it was kind of a comical situation.
Well, so we have the efforts of a turtle to thank for our tomatoes as well. Tim is on the line in Moline, Illinois. Hello, Tim.
Hi there.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, when I heard the show about tomatoes, it made me think of a friend of mine that I work with. He's from Britain, and he absolutely detests the tomato, and it may even be a cultural thing for some Britons. But the story he told was when it was first introduced, that everyone believed it to be poison, and they later understood that because it was the combination of putting the tomatoes on a lead plate. And I wondered if your guest had heard that story before, if he could confirm it or comment on that idea of, or maybe just generally about tomatoes in Britain.
And so maybe the tomatoes really were making people sick, but it was actually what people were eating them off of.
That's the story my friend told me, yeah. So I wanted to get a second opinion on that.
Arthur, have you heard of that?
I have heard of that, but I don't actually think that could have happened. I mean, there were a lot of ways that people in the 17th century poisoned themselves. I mean, mercury was one of the major treatments for almost anything that ailed you, and, you know, mercury is a neurotoxin. I mean, medicine was pretty bad back then, and doctors were kind of the gatekeepers of what entered the diet. So when the doctors decided something was bad for you, and the doctors were incredibly ignorant. So, yeah, it's possible that they were on lead plates, but I think the main basis for it was just the strangeness of it, and then the sort of declarations by botanists and doctors that this was a poisonous thing that you didn't want to eat and that wouldn't do you good. And I think people in those days were so sick so often, you know, they had very primitive ideas of hygiene that, you know, it's easy, you know, it's just like you, when you get sick, that restaurant you ate, you always blame that for whatever sickness you got, even though you probably were, you know, developing something before you even went into the restaurant. I think it would have been easy for someone to blame tomatoes for that developed, you know, after they ate a tomato, and it probably was something else.
Tim, thank you so much for your call.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hazel's on the line now in Iowa City. Hello, Hazel.
Yes, hello. I read an article about tomatoes and the splicing or the genetic engineering, and they said that they had there was a gene that was used in some of the tomatoes that came from the fish that from the bottom of the ocean where it was very cold, and they were trying to get the tomatoes to last longer and to, you know, be able to handle different changes of weather and so on and so forth. So I got one of these tomatoes. I think it was one of those tomatoes. I can't prove it. But it was hard and awful in the wintertime. And I tasted, to me, now this sounds really crazy, and I've told the story a few times. They always say I'm nuts. I could taste a sort of a fishy taste to it, and I didn't understand it. But I didn't buy them anymore. And then I ran into a friend of mine in the grocery store, buy a tomato stand. And I was talking, and I said something about it, and the wife said she tasted it also, and the husband verified that tasted to them to her like fish. The husband said no, but to her and to me. And we started talking about it, and it turns out that we're both called super tasters. Now, it sounds crazy that I could taste the gene of a fish and the tomato. But anyway, maybe you clarify that for me.
All right, thanks a lot, Hazel.
Sure. Yeah, that gene of the fish and all that, I mean, that was done experimentally. That was never introduced in any tomato you would ever buy. I mean, that's the only genetically modified tomato that was actually introduced for a while back in the 90s was this Flavor Saver, which was produced in California. The gene was not from a fish. It was actually from some other plant, and it was the idea that it silenced one of the ripening genes. It was called an antisense gene, and so what it did is it silenced one of the normal tomato ripening genes, and this slowed the ripening process. And that indeed was commercially sold for a while. They called it the McGregor, and it just wasn't a very good tomato, so it never succeeded, and plus there was a huge amount of argument about it, and people who opposed it and had tomato smashing parties and so on. And so that was the last effort to create, to introduce commercially a genetically modified tomato. I think it's possible that it could happen again sometime, but it would have to be a really, really delicious tomato for it to kind of pass all of these hurdles, both sort of our suspicion of genetic modification and the high costs of developing a tomato that way compared to traditional breeding. So in the short term, I don't see anything, any genetically modified tomatoes being sold anywhere. And there never was a fish gene, I'm sorry to mm-hmm. tell you, but tomatoes have a lot of different flavors. They have different acids, they have different umami flavors, which are often like what you would associate with fish oils. So maybe it was just something in a natural tomato flavor that was kind of similar or reminiscent of a fish flavor.
Well, and a lot of those tomatoes that we buy at the grocery store, we get at restaurants throughout the year, do taste awful, whether they taste fishy or not.
Yeah, right. Well, you could definitely, there's something fishy about them.
Right, right. Maybe not technically.
Yeah. Right.
So, and there has been backlash against these mass-produced, homogenized tomatoes that stand up to the boxing and the shipping very well. And of course, you know, we were talking about when those tomatoes were created, and that was a revolution that made it possible for people to have tomatoes throughout the year everywhere. But with this backlash, with people looking for better tasting tomatoes, that kind of falls into two different categories when you go to the store, when you look for seedlings or when you look for seeds, and that's the heirloom category of tomatoes and then the modern hybrid, which those are bred, you know, between different plants to bring out different characteristics. Where do these heirloom tomatoes come from?
Yeah, well, heirlooms, you know, an heirloom is a tomato that's open pollinated, which means you don't have to cross two strains. It pollinates itself because all tomatoes basically pollinate themselves. They don't, occasionally you'll get a cross when a bee takes some tomato pollen from one flower to the next. But generally, the pollen is produced inside the capsule sort of the flower, and it self-pollinates. And so when you have had a variety of tomato for a long time that's self-pollinating over generations and generations, it develops a certain purity so that you can just keep planting the seeds as they're produced in the tomato, and they come back up pretty much the same. And that's an heirloom, basically. It's just that's the traditional way that tomatoes have grown, and that's the traditional way that farmers have grown them the next year. They save the seed from some tomatoes and grow it out again. So hybridization, is a relatively recent thing. I mean, it was used, I think it's really a 20th century invention for the most part. And it came to the tomato industry much later, really didn't catch on until like the 70s or 80s. And it has a lot of advantages because you can, If you know what you're doing, you can take two strains and you get what's known as hybrid vigor. In other words, you'll have one strain that you're looking for, say, for flavor or for, you know, hardiness, and then another one that has some resistances to certain organisms or, you know, has a growth pattern that you like. And so an heirloom is just what it is. And a lot of them, of course, were handed down from generation to generation because they tasted really good. And people who grew them in their backyards or wherever didn't care about producing large amounts of them and weren't necessarily concerned about losing some of them to pests. They just were there for the flavor because that's what us backyard farmers care about. And so the heirloom is basically a backyard tomato. I mean, that's what it is. And you can grow them commercially, and now people are growing them commercially. They are harder to grow because they are subject generally to more of these kinds of pressures from the environment, whether they're, you know, mildews or rots and bacteria and all the other things that can go wrong with a tomato plant.
We do still have time to take a few calls if you'd like to talk about maybe an heirloom variety you've discovered that you'd like to share with the world. The number to call is 866-780-9100. And Arthur, I think that these heirloom tomatoes have been romanticized a little bit, that, you know, many of us think sort of the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, it's an heirloom tomato, it's going to taste better than anything else I could grow.
Yeah, I mean, it's heirloom has become a branding device. It's like any other device where you associate the name with something good, you know, whether it's a pair of shoes, a purse, or a tomato. And so that isn't to say that a lot of heirlooms aren't really good, because I think many of them are very delicious if grown properly by a farmer who knows how to do it. But there's nothing per se about an heirloom that makes it better. And in fact, there are a lot of heirlooms that people grow and really love that I don't like, and it could be my personal taste buds. You know, everybody has kind of different things they're looking for in a good tomato. I mean, I think everyone likes pretty sweet tomatoes, but everyone wants a different sort of mix of sweetness and acidity, which is sort of what makes the tomato a tomato, plus all these other volatiles, these million, you know, 500 different chemicals that come out of the tomato when you cut it, and you just smell them for instance sometimes, but they are a very strong part of the whole experience of tomatoes. So yeah, I mean, the short answer is just because it's an heirloom doesn't mean it's good. And I've seen supermarkets selling heirlooms in the winter that clearly were harvested much the same way as a tomato, you know, picked green and shipped long distances. But, you know, they think they can sell them because they're called heirlooms. And they're certainly no better than any other tomato, and in many cases worse.
Right. You know, in my own garden, when we discovered heirloom varieties, that's the direction we went entirely the next year. And then we found some of them to be a little disappointing. And now we are a little more sane, and we do a mixture of some of the modern hybrids, like the Early Girl and the Better Boy, that kind of thing, and some
right.
of the heirlooms that we love.
They're a little more reliable. I mean, the hybrids are a little bit more reliable in terms of getting some tomatoes. I mean, I've grown a lot of these things, especially when I was working at the book. I looked far afield for all kinds of interesting tomatoes. And, you know, the grape and cherry tomatoes are more reliable. They're closer to the wild variety of types of tomatoes, and they have all these things bred into them by nature that just from, you know, evolution, that make them hardier. And they also tend to have good flavor. So I count on those, that my garden is going to at least produce those little ones. And then everything else is kind of a crapshoot.
Gene is on the line from Osage. Hello, Gene.
Good morning. I heard you talking about the heirloom tomatoes. And a few years ago, I tried some along with my regular standby, which is Big Boy and Better Boy. But the heirloom tomatoes had such delicate skins, and they cracked, there were cracks formed, and so they would spoil before they really got ripe.
Yep, that's the story with the heirlooms. I mean, they're beautiful things, they're really unusual, no two heirlooms are alike, but they don't last as long. And also, you know, when they crack open like that, you got to eat them right away, and sometimes they crack before they're ripe. So yeah, I think that people who know how to grow them out in the yard where there's a minimum of, and if the weather is right, because some of the cracking will develop as a result of certain weather conditions. If it gets a certain degrees, the temperature goes down a certain amount, it affects the shape of the skin as it's developing, and you'll develop these cracks and zippers and things. But yeah, I mean, they're just not as reliable. They're subject to more of these pressures of all kinds, and that's why they develop hybrids, you know.
Gene, thank you so much for your call. And before we go, I want to look at the future of the tomato, because you also in your book profile some people who are working to breed better taste back into the tomatoes that we see in our supermarkets. So what do you think the future looks like for our tomatoes?
Well, I have this dirty little secret. Which is I think that a lot of the hybrids, I mean, one thing, when I was in Italy, everyone in Rome raved about a tomato called the Pecchino. So I assumed, oh, this is some ancient tomato that's been around forever. And I went down to the place where they grow them, and it turns out that area has only been a tomato growing area for about 25 years. It does have, it has wonderful water that's very, has a lot of salt in it, and that's good for tomatoes. And it turns out that tomato, the most popular brand, is actually an Israeli hybrid called the Chern. And that's the one that all these people in Italy, who, you know, who could be more appreciative of a good tomato than the Italians? That's the one everybody loves. And so you have to sort of be flexible about, you know, in my view, you know, just because something is a hybrid doesn't mean it's to be shunned. And there are a number of American breeders who are now trying to get flavor. And there's a brand called Del Cabo Farms that are grown down in Mexico. They have a geneticist breeder who I profile in my book there. Conti Rawal is developing a lot of delicious tomatoes. There's a guy in Florida named Jay Scott is doing the same thing and has a tomato called the Tasty Lee that's I love. It's a hybrid, and it's very hardy, you know, so it'll ship. But it has a lot of flavor, and that took a lot of work, And I really respect these breeders who have developed these things for the modern world. I mean, you know, that also taste good.
Well, it sounds like the future is bright for tomato lovers. Then, Arthur, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Arthur Allen is the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we'll tell you what to do with your homegrown tomatoes, the resurgence of home canning, and we'll talk to the official veterinarian of the Iowa State Fair. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Well, you can go out and eat, and that's for sure, but there's nothing that a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your own very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs and eat them with gravy. You can eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle. A homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't.